I'm Sean Graham, and what's oldest news this week is the 1921 federal election. Yes, we are into the election season here in Canada with the campaign fully rolling all across the country. And yet just recently, a new book came out looking back at the 1921 federal election entitled Times of Transformation, the 1921 Canadian General Election by Barbara Messimore. It's part of the UBC Press Turning Point Election Series. This has been featured on the show before. I'm a big fan of federal elections and looking at them historically because I think they offer a wonderful window and a snapshot into the country at any given point in time. So I am fully the market for these books. And 1921 is a very important election and a transformative election here in Canada. There's so much going on coming out of the First World War. There's still a lot of cultural impact of that conflict, the amount of death experienced across the country, as well as those who returned, who were wounded both physically, mentally, and spiritually from everything that happened during the war. So that is all playing out while you also have serious economic questions. Tariffs are an issue during this election. You also have the place of Quebec and its electoral power, great significance given that we're coming out of the conscription debates during the First World War. You have the increasing divide between urban and rural Canada. And of course, it is the first election with women's suffrage. Some women were able to vote during the 1917 election, but this is the first election with women's suffrage. And what that means for electoral politics, campaigning, and just where the country is in 1921. So it's a really wonderful book. And again, I'm the market for this. I love these books. It just happens that it's coming out during the federal election. But even if it wasn't, this is something that I would certainly be interested and want to talk about. So I was very pleased that Barbara had some time for me a little earlier. I really enjoyed the conversation. Think you will as well. So let's get right into my chat with Barbara Messimore. All right. And Barbara Messimore joins me now. Barbara, how are you today?
Yeah, very well. Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Really excited to have you here to talk about Times of Transformation, the 1921 Canadian general election. As I said in the intro, I love books about Canadian elections. I love looking back on these moments because it's really does serve as a bit of a snapshot of a point in time. And certainly there's a lot going on in 1921. But before we get into some of the specifics that are in the book, this is part of the UBC series on transformational elections in Canadian history. And I want to know to start, why 1921? And what is it about this particular election that made you want to pursue this project?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, as you say, it's part of this series that Ken Carty at UBC organized, and mainly coming at it from a political science perspective in his case, and some of the contributors to the book series are poli-sci people. But I think history's got a good approach to bring to bear on this. And, you know, when he talked to me about turning point elections, I immediately thought of 1921 because it's a big one. A lot of important things happened in that election, and it's kind of a way to talk about a lot of different themes. For one thing, it's our first ever minority government. You know, people have at times talked about Canada, or at least in the past, you know, as being essentially like a two-party system. And I'd kind of push back against that because there was nothing systemic that dictated we had to have a conservative and a liberal party. So you have the advent of a farmers' party, the progressives, most of them progressives. In that year, you've got the first election in which women are eligible to vote on an equal basis with men. You've got the advent of a more systematic labor party in Canada. And of course, it's an era where labor's really a big part of the story, right? There's just a lot of things going on. It's also, I suppose, topical in a sense because it's a tariff election. Right. Tariffs really loomed large. They'd just been through a pandemic. Stop me if any of this sounds familiar, right? So there's a lot of elements to it. Quebec's an important important part of the story too. And really, they're the ones who helped dictate, I think, the liberal success in that election. So there's just a lot of separate threads to it. And I think for historians, it's all about context. It's always about context. You know, poli-sci people have things to offer, but they tend to approach a question in different ways. You know, they're kind of interested in theory, they're interested in models, they're interested in kind of broad trends and voting behavior. But I think when you do a historical analysis, you're interested in the particular circumstances as that time, you know, in that time. So as you say, it's kind of a moment in time, and we can see that manifest in the result in a lot of ways.
Is there such a thing for you in the way you approach this book as this typical ballot box question? You know, a lot of elections could tend to get boiled down to this is the ballot box question. Like you look at 1911, people say, oh, it's the Navy. 1896, you have reciprocity. 88, same thing, is the free trade election. Does that exist for you when you look at any election, really, but particularly in 1921? Or is it just too varied in the circumstances?
Yeah, I think for many voters, it is varied. And yet, you're right that there's sort of some themes that emerge. I mean, I think everybody would agree that 1988 was kind of the free trade election. This coming election, we won't be able to talk about it without talking about Trump, right? That's kind of the subtext of it. I describe 1921 as a tariff election too, and it really was. And people have been critical of the conservative prime minister Arthur Meehan for kind of making it the election issue. But I kind of had tried to suggest in the book that that's maybe not fair to me. And there's plenty of things we can criticize him for besides that. But I would say that it was the organized farmers who pushed that tariff issue to the front of the agenda. So he really kind of had to fight on that basis. There were a lot of other things going on too. And of course, for labor people, they had their own issues that were part of it. The women's suffrage fight had been won, but that lead up was important. I think kind of in terms of the dividing line, tariffs was, you know, they would really be the key point here.
So when we look at then the economics of this period, I mean, the 1920s, the image a lot of people have of them is the time of abundance and, you know, the flappers and jazz and all that's going on. So what is it about tariffs and trade that makes it such a prominent issue in 1921? What's going on economically that this really starts to be an election issue?
Yeah, I mean, that is, you're very right. It is kind of the common perception. You always hear the roaring 20s, yeah, the dirty 30s. You know, we have this kind of shorthand. But we had, during the Great War, a period of very intense inflation. Wages rose very quickly. Wheat prices went up. Prices in general went up. And then immediately in the aftermath of the war, at the beginning of the decade, in the beginning of the 1920s, you have this very steep deflation, and you suddenly had plummeting prices. So one of the things that I think is significant when we look at the rise of organized farmers, wheat prices per bushel had hit a high of $2.63 a bushel. All of a sudden, the month of the election, they dropped to $1.11 per bushel. Jeez. Like that's steep. And Americans were feeling the pain, you know, a lot of this coming from the consequences of the war and European economies kind of reviving. For the Americans were feeling the pain. Prices were dropping sharply. Farms were being abandoned. Businesses were failing. So they pushed through. It was a Republican agenda, an emergency tariff. The emergency wasn't fentanyl, but the emergency was this acute economic crisis, and imposed really punitive measures on Canada. And so Canada's imports are, you know, into the U.S., or I should say exports from Canada, really suffered, especially in agricultural products. And so that was something that hit the farmers hard. They essentially lost access to that market. It started kind of with the emergency tariff measures and then was entrenched in the Ford and McCumber tariff in 1922, just after the election. And then people often point to the notorious Smoot-Hawley tariff in 1930, you know, and people kind of see that as a link in the chain leading to the Great Depression, or contributing to it, certainly. So collapsing farm prices are a big part of this. And at the same time, you know, farmers are feeling put upon because the markets to which they'd like to export their goods are becoming denied to them. And yet they still have tariff protection on things that they buy, farm equipment, for example. So they're kind of stuck between, you know, on the one hand, they're subject to the vagaries of the free market, but on the other hand, they're dealing with policies that are protecting Eastern manufacturing interests, and they really feel that the government wasn't responsive to them. And of course, you've also got the demographics in this, that growth in the prairies has been very significant. You see the steady uptick of seat count for the prairies in Canada's House of Commons. And so, you know, their voices are they now have to be listened to.
And do we see any sort of tension between the farmers' movement, the agricultural movement, and because you mentioned labor earlier, and so the industrial labor that we see maybe more in central Canada, are they in opposition in places? Are they working together, or are they very much their own lobby groups?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. There's not really a simple answer to that. We've often seen in this election that you get progressives. I suppose it's helpful to think of progressives, you know, as not being either on the right or the left end of the political spectrum. You know, and I know today we kind of use progressive as a shorthand for kind of the left side of the political spectrum, and yet it didn't function that way. It really was about the interests of farmers as a group, and that encompassed people that ran the gamut from right to left wing. You sometimes see cooperation between farmers and labor interests, and that would culminate in 1932 with the creation of the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation. And so their banner, you know, their federation, their banner was farmer, labor, socialist. So it kind of brought together those elements. And in some ways, some people have pointed to that as one of the most enduring aspects of this era in politics. The farmers as an organized party flamed out pretty quickly on the federal scene. Probably because they didn't really function as a true political party. You had a lot of idealists there, people who thought that they could purify politics, people who came into this with a very heavy religious orientation. That's a part of this that sometimes in our more secular age gets downplayed a bit. But people have described the progressive movement as a religious movement as much as a political one. And you see that in some of the farmers' periodicals, you know, the newspapers and magazines and whatnot that circulated among the progressive element, that religion was a big part of it. And many of the key players in the progressive movement were people who came from religious life. So there's a lot of cooperation. Sometimes you have people who it can be even hard to pin down who which party they represent or are affiliated with. And actually, that leads me to another point, just kind of a technical one, if you like. But one of the things that I think is important to remember is that it wasn't until 1972 that party affiliations were listed on the ballot. So when you voted for Joe Blow. You didn't know whether he was progressive or labor or liberal, conservative, what have you, right? And so that's kind of something with the there were some election reforms before this election in 1920, the Dominion Elections Act. But it didn't introduce that change. That didn't come until 1972. So sometimes you can, you know, when you say, what's the election result? Well, it's not quite that simple. It, you know, there's a little bit of wiggle room. And in the case of this election, I described it as the first minority government. Not everybody would agree with me. Some people would say, well, you know, Mackenzie King kind of had just made it to the halfway mark. And I would dispute that because I think it's fundamentally dependent upon what votes can he rely upon in the House of Commons. And so if you have people who are, we have a couple of Manitoba liberals who aren't really liberals. They voted against a liberal budget, for heaven's sake. You know? So party discipline wasn't then what it is now, right? So it's really about how many votes could you count upon? And the progressives were, in a sense, kind of an unruly lot. They were responsive to their constituents, and that was a big part of the reform that they wanted to see is to be answerable to their constituents. And so you can't kind of count on them acting as a cohesive block.
Right. Well, that's interesting that you have this group of people that is really trying to answer to their constituents and be responsive to the local concerns of the people who are voting for them, while at the same time, I mean, Mackenzie King is not the first prominent national political figure in the history of Canada, but he is one of the biggest national figures, political figures that we've had. And this is kind of his emergence, really, as the leader of the Liberal Party and coming into government for the first time. What role does he play in the election? How is his position different from, again, this is kind of the same as the 1920s question, where we have this idea of who Mackenzie King was and what he did during his time. And it's kind of hard to think of him as an unknown figure or new to the scene. And yet here we are in 1921. So how does his campaign machine operate at this time?
Yeah, he's an interesting figure. Yeah, certainly. And one of the things that I suppose gets kind of downplayed with Mackenzie King is the extent to which he was identified with labor interests. And so in the leadership convention was it August 1919? We're looking at, you know, that summer we'd had the Winnipeg General Strike. We'd had strikes throughout Canada. We had labor was really a boiling issue. And it's partly because of the question of collapsing buying power, a more robust labor movement, and increased unionization during the war years when labor was scarce. I think worth noting that union membership tends to increase during good times, not bad times. You know, that's when people have the luxury of activism. But Mackenzie King, that was something he brought to the table, and he really played this up that he was a liberal leader who could speak to labor issues, and he brought kind of a lifetime's work, but he really was in some ways a kind of a boy wonder, somebody who did a PhD at Harvard, somebody who was a deputy minister of labor, very senior civil service post at age 26, something like that, you know. So not a charismatic person, but he certainly had that going for him. And you could imagine in the summer of 1919, that loomed large. He also had one important qualification, which was that he was not associated with the conscriptionists. Mm-hmm. And some of the questions you asked me earlier, you alluded to some of the influence of wartime, and maybe you want to talk about that in a bit. I don't want to anticipate, but certainly the fact that he had, as he would put it, remained loyal to Wilfrid Laurier during the war years, had not kind of thrown in his lot with the pro-conscription unionists, and of course was not reelected in 1917 because of that. That helped build a bridge back to support in Quebec. And everybody kind of got that you couldn't be liberal leader without winning the support of Quebec. Mackenzie King could do it, and other prominent liberals could not.
Right. And I think, too, when people think of conscription, certainly Quebec, absolutely important there, but also a lot of the rural vote and the agricultural vote was very much against conscription as well. So you have a pretty powerful coalition then behind you that you can use in that sense. And yeah, I do want to talk about the First World War a little bit, because this is the first election after the First World War. And I've done a lot of work on the war and the way the war was remembered. And the early 1920s, when we think about the commemorative side of things, it's still a period where a lot of the things that are being built and put up are more mourning, in a sense, that they're not quite to the point where they are pushing big ideas of national unity and national identity. There are hints to it, but a lot of it is still trying to mourn the loss of all those who are killed during the First World War. And once we get into the mid-late 1920s is where we start to see things like the Canadian clubs and other nationalistic type of enterprises, with the idea being, well, if all these people died, we have to make it for something. And that's sort of the narrative. That's the death so noble kind of narrative that emerges. But for this election, it's still in that period of folks across the country are still trying to come to terms with and cope with what happened in a lot of senses, in a lot of ways. So, you know, given the population at the time, roughly 8 million and 60,000 people die, Canadians die during the First World War. That's, you know, basically one degree of separation for most folks across the country on knowing somebody who was killed. So with that context, what is the hangover of the First World War, and how does the First World War influence the campaign and ultimately the formation of the government?
Yeah, that's a really important part of it. It is an era where, you know, I do talk in the book, there's some discussion of kind of the general zeitgeist, and I think that's important to get, that it is an era of real disillusionment. It's an era where a lot of conventional models had failed, and people were just feeling maybe a willingness to abandon a lot of traditions of the past, a willingness to experiment in ways they had not. And some of that stemmed from what were meant to be wartime expedients. If you look at something practical like the wheat board, for example, that was a wartime expedient, and you know, people had to be convinced that things like government involvement in marketing wheat, nationalization of railways, this kind of thing, government intervention in things where you hadn't seen it before, there was kind of a greater openness to considering these kinds of experiments. You could also say, thinking about the 1917 conscription election, and I think talking about themes of the election, we can readily agree that one was the election issue. You're essentially voting yes or no on conscription. That might be said to have broken down some partisan habits of the past. And so if you had people who were lifelong liberals but supported conscription, well, they've broken that pattern in 1917, and so it's kind of a easier leap then to go into support of another party. You see the importance of Canadian farmers in producing wheat to meet that need during the war years, with traditional supply lines disrupted. And it kind of makes their significance, their importance, really evident. And so they can kind of capitalize this. And they've actually, in some cases, tasted real prosperity as a result of that higher wheat prices. for women, of course, the war is a big part of it too, that you sort of see in both the farmers' movements and in the women's movement, you see people on the one hand being told, well, yeah, during the duration, we kind of have to lay these secondary considerations aside. And yet the kind of work women did during the war, the sacrifices they made also would help increase their claim to equal rights of citizenship. And I think, you know, in that sense, you see that too. I've already mentioned the gains made by labor during the war years, the increased levels of union membership, that kind of thing too. And of course, the real story, I suppose, if we look at the significance of the war, would be in Quebec, that Quebec had, almost solidly opposed conscription in that 1917 election. There really wasn't a way to for the conservatives to build back that connection with Quebec. And of course, in 1921, the Liberals won every Quebec seat, 65 mm-hmm. seats. So that's kind of the make or break for them. And the Conservatives simply had no capacity to rebuild that. And then, of course, the leadership of Arthur Meighen. Arthur Meighen was the person associated with all the measures that helped kind of ram that result through in 1917, the Wartime Elections Act and the Military Voters Act and all the things that people said, you may as well just say the legislation is about forcing the election of a conservative government. And of course, Quebec resented that. They resented Ontario's provincial language policies. You know, Arthur Meighen had nothing to do with that, but somehow he ended up wearing that one too. Repressive measures against the Winnipeg strikers in 1919. Again, Meehan's personal culpability probably greatly exaggerated there, but he was really the whipping boy. He was somebody associated with all the unpopular policies. And so there's a lot of fallout from the war. And I think even, you know, just that sort of spirit of disillusionment in general, you see it in all kinds of things. You see it in rising divorce rates after the war. You see it in all kinds of willingness to embrace things that are different and new. And so there's this great openness to considering new ideas.
Yeah, because you have, yeah, six, as I said, 60,000-ish people, Canadians, are killed during the war. But that's out of 600,000 who serve in some capacity. So you have 540,000, a lot of whom are wounded in other ways, physically and mentally, who are coming back. And again, with a population of 8 million, this spreads, right? And the trauma sort of goes around the country. Is there anything for veterans? You know, whenever we send people off to war, it's usually with the promise of, well, when you come back, we'll take care of you. And that was very explicitly said during the war to veterans. And then they come home and oftentimes the promises are not totally fulfilled. So in this election, are veterans a key voting block? Are they being a campaign to, or is it these other issues that we've already talked about, some other that we'll get to, that are driving a lot of the discussion?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly was, you know, this sense, not just in Canada, but around the world too. And I was going to say, when you're talking about the casualty rates and whatnot, I mean, you know, if you want any explanation for the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, the Russian casualty rate of something, what was it, 76% or something like that, goes a long way toward explaining that. You don't, that's not too mysterious, I suppose. That's an example of people being willing to embrace the unconventional. I do think that every party made an attempt to appeal to veterans. It's kind of written into the platforms of, you know, veteran retraining programs and things like that. You see it in labor, I suppose, this tension between wanting to reintegrate veterans into the workforce and, in some cases, women's issues. You know, that's one thing we often think of, and I talk about this in a couple chapters in the book. You know, in the women's movement, we were used to seeing the forces of reaction, you know, the kind of on the right end of the spectrum opposing a move into any non-traditional roles for women. But you also get that for from the labor movement too, that, you know, there was one BC labor activist, he said he had no patience with the pet hobby of noisy suffragettes, you know. And so this kind of impatience with that issue, that gender issues are secondary. This is kind of class warfare, and we don't need this distraction. So, but yeah, I mean, the short answer to your question is that, yes, various party platforms did, in fact, all party platforms did make that nod to veterans' interests.
Now, you have mentioned, of course, this is the first election where we have full participation by women in Canada. 1917, there were some women who were allowed to vote based on the parameters of that time, but 1921 is the first time with full participation. Now, just a quick one off the top, and this is one of, like, if this was like cable news, you'd say this is like a gotcha question. But do you think that the outcome of the election was changed or would have been different if women had not had the right to vote in 1921?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I'm afraid I do not have a good answer for you there. The one thing I can tell you is that the numbers greatly increased. I provide stats in the books for the number of votes cast, and we had a much larger electorate for sure. Whether, you know, women's votes proved to be determinative, I can't say. I think that one thing I suspect, I suppose, is that the influence of women in farming organizations in the prairies was pretty important. And I would say that, you know, these were movements that were congenial ones in a way, that for a lot of women, their first entry into public life was through farming organizations in both on the prairies and in Ontario, certainly. And so I think that the tariff issue was also important to farm women. The progressives courted farm women in periodicals and things, talked about the availability, or I should say lack of availability, of labor-saving machinery and things that was kept expensive by prohibitive tariffs. And so they kind of made an effort to appeal to farm women. And really took them seriously, which some parties did not do. I should add that all the parties, when it became clear that women in 1918 were going to get the vote and that was going to be reflected in the next election, everybody then jumped on that bandwagon. Nobody wanted to be left behind. But I think for the progressives, it was sincere and it was kind of baked in right from the beginning that they took women seriously. And that kind of leads me to one of the figures. I talk about some of the people who I think are especially interesting in this election. One of them is Agnes MacPhail, who would be the first female MP elected in Canada. And she was a progressive from Grey County, Ontario, a school teacher. And for her, it was really all about farmers' interests. This was, you know, women's suffrage wasn't kind of, obviously she supported women's suffrage and supported women in politics, but her big issue was farm issues. And so I feel like those movements are in some way closely connected. MacPhail was somebody who, you know, she had a rough ride in Canadian politics. One of my favorite stories is her speaking at a political meeting and somebody called out, "Oh, Aggie, don't you wish you were a man?" She responded, "Yes, do you?" But she later said, no, she didn't really want to be a man, but she wanted to be treated like one in Parliament, right? So, yeah, she's an interesting figure. And of course, she was acutely self-conscious when she came into the House of Commons. All the members would stand when she entered and things, and she just didn't want any of that. But that was the time, right?
Yeah. So you mentioned that progressives did take women seriously as a voting bloc. were women voters and women who are entering the electorate now for the first time, when they were engaging with campaign materials, how were they assessing whether or not these efforts to court their vote were serious or not? Like how, as a voter, this is something that people struggle with today too. Like the campaign says something, but I mean, okay, campaigns say a lot of things. And there's a line from Veep that I think about a lot where the Julia Louis-Dreyfus character says, "It's just the party platform. It's a list of things we're not going to do." And you know, I think about that line a lot, especially during campaigns. So for women who are now being actively courted in a different way, I mean, parties would reach out to women before because there's influence with partners and just socially. But now they're saying, vote for it. You can vote for us now. Vote for us directly. And how are women navigating that space, trying to determine the seriousness of the proposals that are being presented to them?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like, I think Thomas Kurar, the progressive leader, in some ways did it best because he talked about the practical economic benefits of progressive policies. He talked about how the tariff was in some way damaging to their self-interest, that it kind of had a negative impact on their quality of life. But he also talked about, and I think quite sincerely, about a wish to purify politics and to elect good men who are not simply self-interested, right? I just, when you raised this question, I flipped open the book to one of the political cartoons that I included. And I always think political cartoons are very revealing. This one's from the Vancouver Daily World, and it would have appeared just a couple of weeks before the election. And we've got the caption, "Miss Debutante will vote this year." So we've got two women, one sitting at a dressing table, and she's got all these glossy photographs of politicians, and she's saying, "But my dear, they're all so good looking, you know." So, jeez. You know, this is good. Yeah, this is kind of cringe, right? You know, yeah. So, you know, I do feel that it would be hard, I suppose, for women voters to wholly believe in the sincerity of politicians who perhaps did not take their demands for simple justice seriously before that. And, you know, one of the other things that's talked about in the book is the use of kind of theater, if you like, by suffragists who wanted to kind of show people the ridiculousness of this policy that denied half the population the right to vote. And so, you know, one of the great brains behind this was Nellie McClung organizing a mock parliament. And there were several such, but where they pretended that a delegation of men was asking for the vote. And they'd say, well, you know, men belong on the farm and we don't want them upstate, and it's really not, you know, but she did it very skillfully. And I think people like Nellie McClung and other suffragists were really effective voices. They weren't like British suffragettes who were often very militant and smashing windows and going on hunger strikes and chaining themselves to the rails and things like that. They used a kind of a gentle ridicule approach, and I think it was an effective one.
So clearly there's a lot going on in the 1921 election, and you know, we encourage people to check out the book to get depth on more of these issues that we can get to in the time we have today. So I'm wondering, just for people who think about elections or who are interested in elections, what is the legacy of 1921 for you? And is it really, as we said at the top, like a snapshot in time of what's important in this moment? Or does it, because people always say, you know, every election is the most important election of our lifetimes, right? Every single time, it's the same thing. Like, yes. Is there something that we can gain from this as we, you know, somebody who studies the 1920s, 1930s, or moving on, like what do we glean, and what are the benefits of studying elections, and particularly 1921?
Yeah, well, There are some, you know, you could say, well, the progressives kind of flamed out fairly quickly. They didn't cohere as a proper party in the House of Commons. And so that kind of had an effect on their impact. And yet, in some ways, there is some enduring influence. I mean, certainly at the provincial level, like, for example, the United Farmers of Alberta went on to govern in that province for a while. I hadn't mentioned, in fact, the part of this context is you had farmer parties elected in Ontario with the good acronym UFO, United Farmers of Ontario. You had the United Farmers of Alberta. You had, in what, 1922, I think it was, the United Farmers of Manitoba. And so kind of a farmers' movement on the prairies persisted. And, you know, I should say it's not strictly a political movement. And in fact, that was one of the great controversies among the farmers' organizations is, should we be political or should we just think of ourselves as a lobby group? And, you know, there was some resistance to the idea of making it a partisan movement. Some people would say, well, look at Labour in Britain, look how successful they were, and we should emulate that. And that certainly was persuasive in the formation of Canada's Labour Party during the war years. For farmers, you can see it in all sorts of ways. I lived on the prairies for a number of years. You can see it in the cooperative movement, the credit union movement, all sorts of, you know, cooperative insurance, these kinds of things that really still are kind of baked into the DNA of the prairies. And so that's, you know, the grain marketing cooperatives, these are really important. And so as a partisan movement, I suppose you get its eventual evolution into CCF, or at least part of it, you know, where you have the Farmer Labor Socialist Federation, which would eventually become the NDP. James Shaver Woodsworth, who led the labor group in Canada's House of Commons, first elected in 1921, he would become the leader of the CCF. And so you get kind of part of it being played out in that movement. You also get some of them later gravitating into social credit. So that's kind of on what's would become the other end of the political spectrum. You know, this kind of disillusionment with conventional banking models and fiscal policy and whatnot. So there is that. But in some ways, it was the labor part of that that had legs, you know, that really persisted longest in a way. You can also see, though, the legacy in the direct democracy movement. And so when we talk about direct democracy, you know, we're talking about some specific things. We're talking about the use of referenda, citizens' initiatives, and recall of members. And even, of course, fixed election dates was kind of part of the direct democracy wish list, too. And so there's some of those ideas that both in Canada and the United States that would continue to persist. I mean, I would say as a legacy, the introduction of half of the population into the voting process is a pretty significant one. You know, so I would certainly count that as important. Yeah, I think that, and perhaps even an openness to third parties in Canada, that up to that point, we had the Liberals, we had the Conservatives, and now for the first time we have a third and, in fact, a fourth party contending. And that would, incidentally, I kind of hinted this late in the book, but that would end up being a significant point in the King Byng affair in 1926, the fact that, you know, Mackenzie King could say, oh, well, this has never happened before in Canadian politics, that a governor general would refuse the advice of his prime minister. But it couldn't have happened before because we only had two parties, you know, in the political spectrum. So this was kind of a product of the 1920s, of 1921.
Yeah. So clearly a lot going on and a great legacy for this election. And that's why people should go get the book, because a lot more depth and detail in the book. So again, it's Times of Transformation, the 1921 Canadian General Election. Barbara, if people want to get a copy of the book and keep up with the series and everything else you got going on, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, it's available at UBC Press. So I think that's easy to find. Yeah.
And we will link down below to the UBC Press page for the book, and you can get it out fresh, hot off the presses. It's just out recently. So Barbara, thank you so much for joining me today. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks, Sean.
And there you have it, my chat with Barbara Messamore, and I thank her for her time. Again, the book is Times of Transformation, the 1921 Canadian General Election. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from TVO. That's TV Ontario, an article on TVO Today by Jamie Bradburn from September 23, 2019, entitled Canada's First Female MP and the Federal Election That Changed Ontario. And yes, this is a deep dive into how the campaign was playing out in Ontario and the impact the 1921 election had on the province. So while the book that we talked about with Barbara is a wonderful study of the campaign as a whole, this dives in a little bit deeper into what's going on into Ontario specifically, noting that this is really where the Conservatives had their base. They won 37 of the province's 82 seats. And overall across the country, the Conservatives only won 50. So this is the place where they had their success. They didn't win a majority in Ontario of the Ontario seats. A plurality, though, they had 37 to the Progressives 24 and the Liberals 21. So the article gets into why that is the case. Also gets into Agnes MacPhail, a little bit about her riding and how she came to be elected. So just a really wonderful add-on to Barbara's book to get a little more hyper-focused here in Ontario. And well, I'm based in Ontario and grew up in the GTA. So certainly this speaks to me. And I really love when we can get into this sort of stuff. Again, like I said at the start, I'm just very much the market for looking back at elections as this window into the past and what's important at any given moment. So today's historical headline of the week from TVO Today, Jamie Bradburn, September 23rd, 2019, Canada's first female MP and the federal election that changed Ontario. And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcast, like, rate, comment, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab and all the great written material available on the site as well. And if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's old is news at gmail.com. So again, thanks so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you real soon for some more What's Old is News.